Hey now, welcome back. I'm Lawrence Brown, just holding the seat warm for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz, not the hot jazz, but the cool jazz, and more at WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that was Blinded by the Light by Manfred Mann, which hit number one on this date in 1977, the year before I was born, 1977. We know we're so happy to have in the studio right now Parag Kandahar. He's the clinical teaching fellow at the Community Development Clinic located in the University of Baltimore School of Law. We're also blessed to be joined by Dorcas Gilmore, attorney and consultant focused on community, economic development, and race equity issues. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you probably heard a bit of the conversation we were having before. Actually, you know, before I get to that, let me say, listeners, we want you to call in, join in the discussion at 410-319-8888. Email us your thoughts. Come on now. Send me an email or two at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet at Mark Steiner. Comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. And you know you can hit me up on Twitter, BMoreDOC on Twitter. Yes, yes, yes. You know, I'm sure the both of you heard a bit of the discussion that we've been having. And, you know, a lot of times I know listeners are saying, well, you know, you're talking about these deep issues of injustice, of inequality. What are some of the solutions, right? That's like often the big question. People want solutions. So I said, you know what? I'm going to beat the listener to the punch by bringing on folks that will be talking about solidarity economics. You know, how do you see this approach fitting in? And I guess start off by telling us a little bit about your work and then how you see this fitting in.
Thank you again for having us.
Absolutely.
So my work has been focused on Baltimore and really understanding what the economic development challenges are, particularly in Black communities,
right?
And working on issues of business development and equity in development. And then a little bit at the summit, the national level with the NAACP, and thinking about race equity again.
Right.
And having the opportunity to see some positives, some solutions in a variety of places that I'm glad we'll be able to talk about today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us here.
My pleasure.
And I have to say, you know, we played Blinded by the Light. I wish it was the Bruce Springsteen version, being a Jersey boy.
All right.
You know, but it's okay. I work at the University of Baltimore, as you said. You know, currently we basically have students supporting grassroots organizations, nonprofits, social enterprise, a whole range of different kinds of community businesses. And I came to this work working in immigrant communities,
right,
and seeing, you know, the whole range of, you know, the ways in which folks are abused, the way in which folks struggle,
right,
and the fact that there are all of these parallel challenges that folks have from different communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I came into this work really thinking, you know, what are the solutions?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can we build, and what are ways in which lawyers in particular, but, you know, folks who want to see change can work together to address those issues.
Absolutely. Now, let's start at the very basic level. What exactly is solidarity economics?
So solidarity economics has a variety of definitions in the U.S. and globally. It's actually a global movement. And the idea of an economy that is really focused on equity, on inclusion, on direct democracy, and sustainability that is in harmony with the earth.
Right.
So those are some of the core principles in addition to cooperation and collaboration with one another. And thinking about how do we restructure and highlight the places in which we are already doing these kinds of collaborative solidarity economic practices, particularly in communities of color,
right?
Because we've had to,
right?
So how do we think about moving from the micro to more macro solutions that put those values at the heart of economic exchange?
Now, I'm, as a student of history, you know, we've been talking a lot about history, and part of what, of course, enslavement of African people did was strip wealth, and Black people were working for the gain and the profit of others, mm-hmm. right? And that's also what segregation, we talked about differences in property values based on which neighborhood you lived in, how race basically has an effect on property value. So again, the impact on wealth, because home ownership is such a big part of that. But cooperative economics, solidarity economics, is not exactly new in the Black community, right? We've had Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Of course, that was destroyed by race riot, white supremacist mob. But you also had other examples, Sweet Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. You had Harlem in New York. There's been, farmers in the South that had co-ops. This is not new, but what is it that solidarity economics can do in oppressed communities, in vulnerable communities today that I think your approach might teach us about?
Well, you're right. I mean, this is not something that's new. Mm-hmm. I think, as a student of history, it's threatening sometimes to the powers that be, right? And you said that, Black Wall Street was, destroyed. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of stories and sort of historical records of, the attack on this kind of organizing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there is a history, of this kind of economic organizing that went alongside civil rights organizing, particularly in the Black community.
Mm-hmm. What's an example of that happened during the civil rights movement, economic collaboration?
So one example is the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, which came directly out of the civil rights movement and was hand in hand in thinking about Black liberation,
right?
That Black liberation requires a level of economic interdependence with one another in a way that supported the whole community. So again, not independence, but interdependence.
Right.
And so that's one institution. Frankly, a lot of the Black labor organizing was really of this tradition.
Right.
And labor and Black cooperatives worked hand in hand.
Like Asa Philip Randolph.
Exactly.
Who organized Black porters, actually led the first march on Washington, I believe, in the 40s.
That's right.
And then helped organize that march on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963.
Exactly.
Right. So the labor movement, Black labor movements, was, you're saying that's also an example of cooperative economics.
And solidarity.
And solidarity.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's fantastic. How do we implement this, though, now? Because part of the impact, we talked about this earlier, of say, slavery, is sort of splitting people apart, breaking families apart, and sort of this thinking that I got mine. Right. I can do this by myself. But you're saying we need to be interdependent. So how do we flesh this out so that people can have real power in this sort of capitalist context that we're in here in America?
Well, the American dream is to have your own. Right. And to have, your own home, your own everything. But, we have plenty of examples. It's the 74th anniversary of Executive Order 9066.
Okay. Right,
when 120,000 Japanese Americans were basically taken from their homes, from everything they owned, and put into concentration camps in different parts of the internal U.S.
Mm-hmm.
They owned their own,
right,
and then they came back to nothing.
Right.
So owning your own by yourself, mm-hmm. without that recognizing the interdependence, without building those connections, doesn't mean that you're necessarily secure, right? And so how do we... So part of this is really thinking about, collective ownership and about how power, comes from, these principles of owning together and working together, right? And so that's, how do we do that in, specific ways? There are a lot of things that people are doing informally already. Mm-hmm. As Dorcas had mentioned earlier, just as a matter of survival, you see this in immigrant and refugee communities. Mm-hmm. You see this in poor communities, throughout the city, throughout the country,
mm-hmm.
where folks come up with new ways in which they can support one another. All right, I can take your kids to school, or I can watch over your kids because you need to get to work. So how do we, find ways that both value that and also add more, support for that kind of organizing?
Right.
I just wanted to underscore a piece of what Parag was just saying.
Sure.
And highlighting it within the context of Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That, absolutely.
That at the heart of a lot of movement building
mm-hmm.
is really this concept mm-hmm. of cooperation and collective action.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone, we might not be able to create the kind of change that we want
mm-hmm.
and that we would hope for the world. But together,
mm-hmm.
that we have overcome a range of injustices. We still have many more to go.
Right.
But we have created opportunities and had some successes in our communities when we were of the mind of cooperation and collaboration.
Right.
And this new quote-unquote new generation
mm-hmm.
of Black-led, woman-led, queer-led
mm-hmm.
organizing
mm-hmm.
Is very important,
mm-hmm.
a very important reminder of what this looks like.
Mm. Absolutely. Once again, listeners, join us in the discussion here. Call us at 410-319-8888. We're here with Parag Kandahar, who's from the University of Baltimore School of Law, the Community Development Clinic, and Dorcas Gilmore, who's an attorney and consultant focused on community economic development and race equity issues. And we're really trying to describe a way that the community can pool this money together and think about ways in which we can support our own well-being and being able to thrive and not just survive economically. I think about, as a part of this, the worker co-ops that I've been reading about, like in Cleveland, whether it's anything from like a laundromat to, some sort of production facility for some small widget or another, really plays a role. I've been looking at even how, Parag, I've seen you talk about like where we bank our money
mm-hmm.
and how that plays a role. I think about the soap that I'm buying made by the Unilever and how the Lever Corporation went into Africa, what we now know as the Democratic Republic of Congo, and exploited the people after King Leopold in sort of extracting palm oil, which was the basis of the soap. Mm-hmm. And so I'm beginning to think right. much more deeply about how even my 401k here as a professor at Morgan,
mm-hmm.
What stocks are my, what companies are my stocks in that may be supporting and really sort of practicing oppression somewhere around the world? I'm beginning to think more deeply about that. What does solidarity economics tell me about what I should be thinking about as it relates to my investments or as it relates to like these sort of cooperatives that could be built so that people have employment?
That's absolutely right. And I think that, folks may think like this is so big and mm-hmm. this is, overwhelming. But we make decisions every day, right? And we can think about how our individual decisions, make a difference. And then collectively, how our decisions can actually make a significant difference.
Mm-hmm.
There's this whole campus divestment sort of effort around clean energy,
right.
Or divesting from fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
The Rockefeller Foundation just made this big announcement that they're divesting from all fossil fuel, investments for their endowment.
Right.
That's a major move,
mm-hmm.
You see sort of on the big stage, you see that happening. But you also see with individuals, people being more conscious about, where am I buying this from?
Mm-hmm.
Buy local campaigns have become a bigger
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where are these things coming from, right?
Right.
And that, I think the real interest when we talk about solidarity economics is that this shouldn't only be for 10% of the population or 20% of the population. You know, how do we make it more feasible for any community member, regardless of income, regardless of access, mm-hmm. to be able to get good, healthy food that's grown, you know, nearby,
right.
To get, you know, access to services and to other things that they need that are coming, you know, from their community members.
Absolutely. I want to take a call. We have a caller online. Clarence, thank you for listening to the Mark Steiner Show. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. I would love to see humanity looking upon itself as one and not the individual groups that looking to protect the interests of those who belong to that group. When you look at the reality of the situation, and particularly when it comes to black people, the resources to sustain that black community or the black group as a whole, we don't have them. We have no manufacturing base such as other ethnic groups in other countries have to manufacture goods, import them, and become entrepreneurs on a massive scale, you know. And I won't mention any names, but there are certain co-ops around here who import from their own country that manufacture there who will tell you point blank, we won't sell to black people.
Mm.
So, you know, when until such a time comes when humanity is looking at themselves as one with the interests of all
mm-hmm.
instead of the individual groups, I don't see any. Well, you can make a change and progress on an individual basis here and there, and hopefully maybe one day that might amount to that thing that I'm saying here. But right now, I don't see it. Thank you.
Thank Bye-bye. You, Clarence. We appreciate your call. Clarence sounds skeptical that we may have this concept, solidarity economics, cooperatives, but how do we make sure that we're addressing racial equity issues even in the midst of this, right? Because it's easy to sort of say, oh, let's just all do this wonderful thing, but still sort of reproduce racist outcomes. So how do we make sure this happens? And you all are lawyers, so you can show us, right? how that can happen.
Or how it can't happen.
Right. So I think the piece regarding individual mm-hmm. focus is important. But in thinking about the kinds of change that we're talking about, it really does take this kind of four-level approach.
Okay.
As we're thinking about structural racism.
Right.
Or structural racialization, that it is the individual level, the interpersonal level, the institutional level,
mm-hmm.
and the systemic level.
Mm-hmm.
And that the caller is correct, mm-hmm. that in order to have the kind of change that we're talking about on a large scale, that we do have to address change on all of those levels and make sure that as we're talking about change, that we don't get stuck in the individual and the interpersonal,
mm-hmm.
But also are thinking about systems and institutions. So I think that is really important. If what we're talking about here mm-hmm. today in terms of solidarity economy mm-hmm. places race equity at the center.
Yes.
And that I'll say uh-huh. that a solidarity economy that doesn't place race equity at the center will not achieve the kinds of outcomes that we're talking about.
Absolutely. Parag.
No, I absolutely agree with Dorcas about that. And I think, you know, I mean, the caller mentioned, you know, some pieces that, you know, maybe, I mean, that he felt weren't in the community.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we really have to build, you know, from the assets with the community. I don't know that I, you know, necessarily agree mm-hmm. with what we do or don't have in, you know, in different communities. But, you know, I mean, there's a history of history of working together, of collaboration, mm-hmm. of resistance, mm-hmm. of struggle, and of power. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that to not recognize that And not to build from that, particularly within the Black community, mm-hmm. but then also with other communities, you know, it leads us to this path of we can't do it, right? And it's too hard. And I think it is hard and it's different, but it's not impossible, you know, and we need to sort of recognize where people have come mm-hmm. And where they've come from. And to me, like, that's, you know, the real energy that I get from this work mm-hmm. is that, you know, there are these incredible connections that we're seeing. And we have to have some tough conversations. I mean, we really do. We have to have tough conversations that are transparent mm-hmm. about why are we where we are now, mm-hmm. right? Some of the conversations you had earlier. Mm-hmm. And where are we going to go? You know, that it's not going to be hunky-dory until we actually, you know, address these, you know, disparities.
Right. Now, are either of you doing any work now that will actually help manifest this as a reality? You know, what's one way that you're seeing this actually play out, and how could we go about, you know, building the solidarity economy?
So currently one of the pieces of this that I'm focused on is the ways in which legal supports mm-hmm. can assist mm-hmm. In building more connection and amplifying what is already happening on the ground. And so previously you talked about how the law has created
yes.
and cemented exclusion.
Right.
And so the question of how can the law support inclusion mm-hmm. and equity, not from the perspective of litigation, mm-hmm. right? That you have to go to court to get it.
Right.
But that the law has enabled the economy that we have currently, mm-hmm. right? Every way in which we do business has been supported by policy right. and legislation.
Right.
And so the question of how can the law be used to advance equity? Mm-hmm. How can it support collaboration? How can lawyers mm-hmm. actually facilitate that process as opposed to, in some instances, being
reinforcing it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we think of Charles Hamilton Houston
right.
And his famous quote
right.
that lawyers are either a parasite on society, right, or agents for change. And so in that, there is the opportunity to think about the law as a vehicle for creating change. And so working with communities to ask that question, mm-hmm. what could the law do to support the kinds of good institution building, movement building that's already happening?
Absolutely. And before we go to break, Parag, what is your next project? What do you see happening on the ground with Solidarity Economics?
Well, Dorcas and I are actually working together with John Duda to kind of build a space that will help to activate solidarity economy work. Mm-hmm. We're calling it BASE, Baltimore mm-hmm. Activating Solidarity Economy, mm-hmm. Solidarity Economies. And the idea is really, you know, how do we work with the grassroots? Mm-hmm. And how do we also think about some of the solutions that people have used around the country and bring them into Baltimore to make, you know, some of these things actually happen? So the connections between, you know, different members of different parts of the community, different work that people are doing around worker ownership, community ownership of land, mm-hmm. food, all these different, you know, possibilities.
Absolutely. So we're so very happy that you all are here. We're going to come back and continue this discussion. Once again, you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM. And I'm your guest host, sitting in, holding the seat warm from my man, Mark Steiner, Lawrence Brown. It rings a bell, the magic touch. Oh, when I... Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while... Welcome back. I'm Lawrence Brown, sitting in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, The Voice of the Community. And that was The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel, recorded on this day in 1964. We want you to join the discussion at 410-319-8888. We'll be happy to speak to you and hear your thoughts on what we're talking about. And, you know, Dorcas and Parag, earlier in the show, we talked a lot about housing and residential segregation. We talked about the ways in which these policies, racial zoning, restrictive covenants, and redlining, damage the home values and the wealth building potential of people in the Black community. So I'm very much interested in how do we build like a solidarity housing economy, especially when you look at everything that's going on with public housing, the dismantling of it, the privatization of it with RAD, and the Housing Authority of Baltimore City selling off its 22 high-rise towers to private developers and nonprofits. How do we build this solidarity economy when you think about all that's happening with housing right now and the subprime lending that created the housing bubble and the Great Recession, the crisis, financial crisis of 2007, which also hurt the wealth disproportionately of Black people? So how, with all of that in mind, how do we build this solidarity housing economy? Because people are hurting right now with these high mortgages, being put on the street, homelessness. How do we build this solidarity economy with housing?
That is a really good question. And I know, actually, on this program that people have talked about community land trust as an option. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. With a community land trust,
Singer has been a leading advocate in that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so what you have is community ownership, right? Mm-hmm. And that you're putting land in a public trust. Mm-hmm. So that, you can ensure the affordability and the permanent affordability. And I know that there's a long-term sort of conversation going on in the city with the Housing as a Human Right Roundtable.
Right.
Through United Workers and, a whole range of different
Rachel people. Cutler's leading that discussion.
Exactly.
Or facilitating, as she would say.
Yes. Yeah, and you have this amazing, host of folks coming together.
Mm-hmm.
You have, faith-based organizations and labor and, grassroots groups, and neighborhood groups and community development corporations all saying that we have a problem in the city and we have a problem in many cities, particularly as people now want to move into the cities again.
Yes.
Right?
The threat of gentrification.
The threat of gentrification and this wave of, of cycling of people coming in and people going out. Mm. But, the folks who are here, how do they stay here?
Right.
I mean, how do they have a stake, in the development, right? How do they have a stake in the prosperity?
Yes.
Nobody wants a city to not be prosperous.
Right.
We want the people of the city to actually benefit from that prosperity, right?
Right.
And so one part of that is who owns the land, right?
Yes.
And who gets to stay here and who gets to really think about, the accepted rate when you think about your housing costs, the go-to is 30% of your income.
Mm-hmm.
People are spending 50, 60% of their income just to stay in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't have home security.
Right.
Right. That they don't know that they're actually going to be able to stay.
Right.
So land trusts, while complicated, are one, strategy that people are really looking at. There, may be smaller strategies that looking at, smaller buildings and smaller, homes and how to keep people in those homes.
Mm-hmm.
People are talking about sweat equity, teaching people, how to deconstruct and construct homes,
right.
Putting in their sweat equity to actually be able to, own that home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a cooperative, there may be a cooperative way of doing that. That folks are exploring. So those are, some initial, ideas.
Right,
I know
right.
that there are some good examples of things that people have done in Boston.
Yeah.
Dudley Street, that's a great.
Dudley Street Initiative.
Exactly. It's a really great documented, two decades plus, example that it can be done.
Absolutely. Let's take a call from Sunday in Remington, from Remington. You're on the Mark Steiner Show. Welcome.
Yes. Hi to your guests.
Hello, hello.
I like to say that programs like this sound great. They seem to rise up when they're needed. But the problem is this. When these people move on, and they will, the resources and the money allocated to these programs generally dissipate. And the community is left without resources, funding, and people in their community who know how to do these things. We look at the millions, no, the billions of dollars that have come into urban areas in both the low-income white and black community, where wonderful programs have started and floundered when the original people left. So we're put right back where we were. And as for the problem with the homes, the same persons or the same entity that started the disparate value of houses, which is Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae, are still doing the same thing, and no one has stopped them. It was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae that said, we will not fund the buying of houses in black communities. And they did that and still continue to do that. No one has stopped them. That's just a small example. But in conclusion, I'd like to say I'd really like to see them do something which is possible. Get the churches to put their money in the banks, which invests in low-income, not just black communities, but white communities. Because as we know, 70% of our third-party payments, food stamps, aid to families with dependent children, medical, goes to whites. So let's get the churches to focus on helping us to get the banks to help us.
All right. Thank you, Sunday.
Right on. Right on. I absolutely agree. We have a lot to say, I'm sure. You know, and, you know, I would say maybe not the banks.
Right.
You know, that there are some really great, you know, examples of church-based credit unions, low-income credit unions. Mm-hmm. Credit unions are cooperatives, and there are opportunities for them to be really community-based. And I know Dorcas has a lot to say about that. So I'll actually probably come back to that.
This is a really good point in mm-hmm. terms of not only taking, so black communities, low-income communities, mm-hmm. taking money elsewhere, but in the institutions that we already are, like churches or religious institutions, creating their own credit unions, and that there really is or has been a history of African-American church-based credit unions that hopefully will be on the rise. And really thinking about not only the church's financial resources, mm-hmm. but the land of the church as an asset for the community as well.
I want to, you know, push back a bit on the notion of churches, mm-hmm. especially black churches being involved, mm-hmm. Or at least the way that they're involved, because what we saw during the subprime lending was that banks like Wells Fargo went to black churches and black community centers to actually facilitate and help connect the bankers with black congregation members, and they gave a lot of them subprime loans.
Right.
I mean, how do we – don't we need to hold the church accountable? We don't just need the church, you know, in housing, reaping a windfall or passing on profits to big banks, but don't we need what you're talking about, Parag, making sure that they're engaged for the welfare and the benefit of the community and not just sort of passing on profit to the big banks, but actually like these credit unions that actually have more solidarity in mind.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the values that we talked about at the outset of a solidarity economy apply across the board.
Absolutely.
And so the values of equity, the values of cooperation, mm-hmm. of democracy,
right.
direct democracy,
yes,
apply whether we're talking about a nonprofit organization
mm-hmm.
or whether we're talking about a church,
yes,
or any group of people coming together for self-organization.
We'll end it right there. Thank you so much for coming in. I know that was an abrupt ending, but we're going to come back to this conversation. Dorcas Gilmore, Parag Kandahar, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From school funding to testing, you can learn about important issues impacting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's webpage at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. On our way to break, we're hearing from Wipeout by the Fat Boys. Prince Mark D of the Fat Boys was born on this day in 1960.